Hello and welcome to Indie Business Radio for January 26, 2009. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. We've got something new today, of course. We have a live chat with our radio show. To join the chat, just log on to indiebeauty.com and click on radio show, and you're there. Well, speaking of new things and new technologies and everything like that, no doubt we all know that business markets are moving faster than ever these days. Thanks largely to technology, an indie business owner can do business around the world with a push of a button. The ease with which anyone can enter the marketplace is a good thing, but it also means that only the ones that learn how to maneuver well in the new technologically driven economy will be able to withstand the test of time. And for indies, this challenge is quite pronounced. We have to work hard to squeeze every bit of possible benefit out of the new global economy. To help us do that today, we have a very special guest. He is Professor Haya Griva Rao. He is the Athol McBean Professor of Organization, Behavior, and Human Resources at Stanford University School of Business. He is widely published and studies the social and cultural causes of organizational change. His most recent work, including his book, Market Rebels, which we'll be discussing today, explores the role of social movements as organizational change takes place. And many of the concepts that he has researched are easily transferred to the business arena. Today, Professor Rao has taken time from his very busy speaking and teaching schedule to join us to help indie business owners create hot topics and cool solutions to get the quote-unquote rebels in the marketplace working for us. Welcome to Indie Business Radio, Professor Rao.
I'm delighted to join you, Donna Maria.
Tell us a little bit about your professional background and how this topic came to be of appeal to you and how you got this book out there.
That's a great question. I've always been interested in collective action since, I was a teenager in India. And one of the things I realized that in India when I was a teenager was people actually got governments to do things by organizing at a grassroots level. And after I came here to do my PhD, one of the things I realized was how very, very central collective action was to really the establishment of many American industries. And over the last 20, 25 years, I've actually been studying many of these industries, and part of what I wanted to do was pull together a book that actually took all of this research and made it accessible to a wider audience. The central argument of the book is that we think it's the invisible hand of the market that allows for the creation of new industries or new niches or new technologies, or we often think it's the visible hand of great entrepreneurs. Consider, for example, the American automobile industry in the early part of the 20th century. If we ask most people, how was the automobile industry established, often they'll say, well, Henry Ford did it. Unquestionably, Henry Ford was the pioneer who introduced mass production.
Uh-huh.
I should point out, interestingly, Henry Ford got the idea of an assembly line by looking at a small business firm, namely the butcher shop. He quickly saw assembly line techniques were being used in butcher shops and so forth, and he said, my God, you know, maybe we could actually use some of these ideas from the meat packaging area and put it into automobile manufacturing. The real question about Henry Ford, however, is for him to introduce mass production, there needed to be demand. How was demand possible? And if we go back to 1895, when the first gasoline-powered car made by the Duryea brothers was introduced in America, the first reaction of people was, you can't get anyone to sit on an explosion.
Okay.
That was exactly it. And it was amazing. There was absolutely no agreement on what to call the car. The car was of terribly poor quality. There were no roads. Farmers hated the car because it meant chaos for them.
Right.
And the other thing was, You had anti-speed activists who were pedestrians who said, this is a menace to pedestrians. That's the environment in which the car was actually described by many people in 1895 as a devilish contraption. So how did the car actually become accepted in American culture? The answer wasn't Henry Ford. One answer you could give is, well, maybe it was the government. Well, the government was a big customer in France. The War Department and the Post Office bought lots of automobiles in France, but not in America. In America, the government only played a role in 1910 or so. So who was responsible for this? It was actually a social movement. What was that social movement? The automobiling movement. Who powered that automobiling movement? Automobile clubs. Who were members of automobile clubs? And what were automobile clubs? These were early auto enthusiasts who formed self-help societies to exchange information and to protect themselves from legal harassment. What did the auto clubs do? The first thing they did was, they said, my God, we've got to make sure we defuse opposition to the car. So they actually lobbied state governments for statewide speed limits. They lobbied the government for car and driver registration and licensing, thereby providing states revenue and also reducing the anxiety of opponents. The third thing they did was they also crusaded for good roads. Without good roads, you wouldn't obviously have the automobile. Most importantly, what they did, Donna Maria, was they organized reliability contests. What these contests were, hill climbing runs, endurance runs that featured cars that people like you and me could buy. And once people saw these cars performing these kinds of reliability contests, that's when people said, you know what, my God, this is a viable alternative to the horse. So the first such contest was started in 1895, as a matter of fact, on a cold Thanksgiving day in Chicago. And then the last one actually was in 1912. And after that, there were no reliability contests. Why were there no reliability contests? Because by then, the car was accepted as an uncontested part of American culture. Everybody realized, hey, this is a viable, sensible way of transportation. Most importantly, what these contests also did was they actually allowed small producers to develop reputations. At that time, advertising was widely viewed with distrust. How could a small producer develop a reputation? By participating his car in this contest, and if you won, you could advertise. That's why the slogan was, win on Sunday, sell on Monday. And car companies later began to develop advertising campaigns based on their track records in these races. In fact, Buick's ad line was, tests tell. And what was the test? The wins in the car contest.
And that whole story is just so fascinating because the parallels to today's marketplace, handmade and artisan manufacturers of products that have been traditionally made by large companies on assembly lines are huge. And I want to explore those with you. First of all, you talked about how Henry Ford, as brilliant or smart as he may have been to develop the automobile, was not the real catalyst for its expansion. It was really people, real people,
exactly,
forming clubs, forming networks, and talking about how great this car was and showing everybody how great this automobile was, mm-hmm, that sort of caused, we'll just use today's term, of viral. It made everybody interested in it. And that parallel to me is fascinating. Can we use that as very small indie business owners today?
Yeah, that's a great question again, Donna Maria. We, you know, the viral analogy has become very powerful. The interesting thing when I listen to the viral analogy is somebody gets infected and then you get infected, as it were. But the problem is, you know, or put another way, if one person catches fire, his or her neighbor catches fire. And on and on and on it goes. And that's kind of how the epidemic or the virus kind of propagates.
Yes.
But the question, though, is how does any person catch fire in the first place? See, for the virus to begin, some people have to catch fire. How does that happen? And that's kind of where I think what we need is we need activism. We need the joined hands of activists. What do these activists do? They actually construct a hot cause. And okay. What they also do is they rely on very cool techniques of mobilization. Because remember, activists are facing a distracted, disinterested audience with very little attention, with very little cognitive resources. They've got lots of things going on in their minds, and you've got to actually get their attention. How do you do that? You have to actually construct this hot cause, one that has to stir emotion. Often it's either anger or it's pride, and once you do that, it evokes a little bit of discomfort. It often leads to new belief. But what you also need is a cool techniques, cool unconventional techniques of mobilizing people, getting them involved. And part of what they do is they get people to try out new things.
Well, like, so, look at what President Obama did with the Internet. There were hot causes there, and he mobilized people. Is that a decent analogy for what you're describing?
That is indeed a very good analogy. That is a very good analogy. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, the analogy I'd like to sort of use is, you know, think of the quality movement in America. You know, you would expect that a firm would rationally say, you know, we really need to improve quality. But American automobile companies didn't really do that. What kind of jump-started the process? What jump-started a process was a hot cause.
Uh-huh.
What was the hot cause? My God, we are actually going to be consigned to oblivion, you know, by the Japanese imports if we don't do something. So it was, on the one hand, a mixture of anger. It was also a mixture of pride. And part of what they then did was they did lots of cool things like putting in place the Baldrige Prize and a whole bunch of other things. And that's kind of how quality actually transformed American automobile manufacturing in the 1980s, to give you a quick, example. Think of personal computing. Most people think, well, you know, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs played a role in the birth of the personal computing industry. They certainly are people who cast a long shadow. But again, what made demand for the personal computer possible? The answer, if we kind of look back, was the hot cause there was the computer is being used as a tool to control us.
Mm-hmm.
The hot cause was there is this priesthood that manages access to the computers. Ordinary people can't have access and use the computer. And that's when people said, look, we've got to do something to change it so that the computer, instead of being central, becomes personal. Something that you and I could use to personalize, something we could use for our own autonomy. What were the techniques of mobilization used? Think of the word. Lots of homebrew clubs were formed. Look at the word homebrew. It's like making beer, you know, at home. And all these computer enthusiasts got together, they shared information, they exchanged ideas, and out of these homebrew clubs, budding entrepreneurs spun out, new programs spun out, new computers spun out, most important of all, a new cadre of consumers spun out. When all of this happened, that's when the big companies like IBM, or then the Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, they said, my God, this is actually a market for personal computers.
So one of the parallels that we can think about here, and Professor Rao, just so you know, again, as I mentioned to you earlier, most listeners manufacture cosmetics. One of the things that we're dealing with right now is the federal government's attempt to implement some new laws that would curb the behavior of large companies that use undesirable ingredients in cosmetics.
Mm-hmm.
But our companies, the people that are listening to this show, the artisans, the micro, as you say, mm-hmm. the micro companies, mm-hmm. are not using those ingredients. And so what we've been able to do is sort of use that hot topic, that is, if you want to be able to purchase quality beauty products from some place other than an import or from some huge mass-produced production line,
mm-hmm.
need to be in business to do that. And we have rallied sort of around this government issue. Is that an example of one of the things that could be a touchstone for the kind of movement that you're talking about?
Absolutely. In fact, Donna Mary, when you mentioned that, what I instantly think of is the microbrewing movement.
Yes, you know, and there seem to be so many parallels between the handmade beauty products and the microbrew, the handmade breweries that are...
Absolutely.
See, we're going to have to take our first break and come back and talk with Professor Hayagriva Rao of Stanford University, the author of Market Rebels, who is just doing such a fantastic job of showing us some of the parallels that we can capitalize on as indie business owners. This is Donna Maria. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Hi, welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're here this afternoon talking with Professor Hayagriva Rao of Stanford University. He's the author of Market Rebels, How Activists Make or Break Radical Innovations. And, you know, I got to say that indie beauty products manufacturers have some radical innovations. We are making beauty products that the world is familiar with, but we're making them on an artisanal scale, a handmade scale, a micro scale, and the world is not used to that. So Professor Rao is here to share some of his research background and his experience on how other markets have penetrated that mindset and created a groundswell of activity that's created a demand for these unique kinds of products. And one market that has obviously taken place in that we can learn from is the microbrewery market. Right, Professor Rao?
Absolutely, Donna Maria. In fact, you know, the microbrewing market, or rather the movement, is interesting for a number of different reasons. One reason is it's a wonderful counter instance, if you will, to economic theory. So if you look at standard economic theory, it tells us, look, you can't enter an industry which is highly concentrated, where a few players control the market. In America, for example, the big three beer producers control 98% of the market share.
Yeah, and we have a similar situation where cosmetics are concerned, and many of our listeners manufacture cosmetics with large companies like Procter & Gamble and Revlon. There's a few of them that control the marketplace mainly, and they have some brands, you know, some house brands that they own that not everybody knows that they own. So it really does create a concentration of market power in a few companies.
Right. See, this is the interesting thing, because what economics would tell you is there's no way you can enter the market when you have that kind of concentration. In beer, the big three, you know, Anheuser-Busch, you know, Miller, SAB, and Coors, they control approximately 96 to 98% of the market share, depending on which year you look at. Yet, ironically, by 1997, the United States had more independently owned breweries than Germany, even if market concentration in Germany was three times lower. How was that feasible?
Mm-hmm.
The answer was the craft brewing movement. Now, what's the craft brewing movement or the microbrewing movement? How did it grow? The answer was, you know, President Carter legalized home brewing in 1979. Until then, it was illegal to make beer at home. And there were a bunch of people who were trying to push the cause of home brewing. And one of them was a wonderful character by the name of Charles Papazian. Mm-hmm. And what he was doing was he was simply teaching people and learning himself how to homebrew. And one of the things he did in 1978 was he put out a newsletter. And that newsletter, Zymergy, quickly became a magazine for homebrewers, and subsequently it became the basis for the American Homebrewers Association. What was happening was, once the American Homebrewers Association started, particularly after legalization of home brewing by Carter in 1979, you very quickly had beer festivals that sprouted everywhere. So home brewing actually provided entrepreneurs. There was even a beer town university to get people to do home brewing. And by 1983, microbrewers simply became a separate division of the American Home Brewing Association. What did the microbrewers do? The first thing they did was they constructed an enemy. Who was their enemy? Big beer was the enemy. Mm-hmm. Why was it their enemy? Because they said, look, it's a source of thin, tasteless, watery, and over-carbonated beer.
Right.
And they said, that beer, they said, is a source of inebriation and not taste. And as one of them said, you know, big beer sells you stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they advertise and say, choose on taste, but even after you taste it, you're left wondering what kind of taste it is. And so the hard cause was this tasteless, terrible beer. There's a lovely company called Independence Brewing run by a guy called Bob Connors. And, you know, he had a great billboard. And the billboard was Independence. Enjoy it while it lasts.
Right. That's an interesting concept, because what we're seeing in the microbrewing industry, as one of our listeners is pointing out in the chat, Noelle Katai of Vim Essentials, thank you for that comment. She says that the large brewing companies are now snapping up the smaller ones.
Right.
To take advantage of the evolved taste of people, but that took 30 or 40 years for that to happen.
That is very true. That's indeed, absolutely the right thing. But, you know, if the hard cause was this tasteless beer, the microbrewing festivals were the cool techniques of mobilization. Now, one of the interesting things that the craft brewers did was they were on guard against imposters. Who were the imposters? Some were big beer producers. And what did they do? They introduced some of their own brands.
And but that's exactly what's happening now, is that a lot of large cosmetics companies are introducing products that look like they're handmade.
Right. But what these people said is, wait a minute, they're imposters. They're not actually authentic beer makers. Because what was an authentic microbrewer? An authentic microbrewer was somebody who made beer on a small scale, used authentic ingredients and techniques, and was artisanal in production. Now, one of the things was, when big beer started introducing their brands, these people outed them. Not only that, they were also contract brewers. What they said is, look, we're not going to produce beer on our premises. We're going to contract it, and then we're going to sell it as micro beer. And in fact, when that happened, the micro brewing people quickly got together and said, wait a minute, they're imposters as well. Fritz Maytag put it well, you know. The more microbrews there are, the more it will help us all. We're like bacteria in a bottle. Alone, we mean nothing, but if there are a lot of us, we can actually make a difference.
That's exactly what's happening right now. What we're seeing right now is, and it's interesting, the timing of the government's desire to interact last year, and we don't know the status of the FDA Globalization Act, which is what it was called. It was a draft law, for anyone who's listening, just so you know, it was a draft law that would have required all cosmetics companies to pay an annual fee of $2,000. There were some other requirements as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a draft law. It never became a bill, I think, in part because we mobilized against it. I think that was a part of the reason why. However, I do think that it is going to rear its head at some point this year. We don't know when, and we don't know in what form. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that what the microbreweries did, because obviously they were regulated as well. It was totally illegal. At least it's not illegal for us to make beauty products right now.
Right, right.
They had a higher bar than we did, and they were able to mobilize. And it seems to me that we need to be able to do that.
Right. And, you know, one of the lessons that I think one needs to do is you've got to make, big cosmetics the target. You've got to sort of say, look, something that's kind of mass-produced, something that is on a large scale, it's not authentic. And part of what you also want to do, and that's what the microbrewers did, was they reclaimed regional identity. And their argument was, why do you want to be homogeneous? Why can't beer differ from neighborhood to neighborhood, from community to community? Now, the other thing was the festivals and the other things, they allowed these clubs to form. And an important thing for artisanal producers of cosmetics and the like is they really need to think about how do we get kind of consumers to kind of form into clubs.
Uh-huh.
And if you're able to get kind of consumers to form into clubs, what we are able to do is, you can then create, if you will, a wellspring of, public interest, public concern, and so forth. But I think, what would be kind of interesting is if you're able to sort of say, hey, these are, cosmetics. They're made from organic materials.
Right.
They're safe for children. They're safe for teenagers. They don't, cause problems later. You know, all of those claims, of course, are there. But the important thing, I think, is, reclaiming authenticity. And I think things like soap and so forth, I imagine that they can be kind of connected with that, very nicely. I mean, you can see, go ahead.
It's true because at the time when Henry Ford, using our analogy of the automobile, and even the microbreweries before the Industrial Revolution, everybody made this stuff at home anyway.
Right.
And so women used to have soap-making parties in the fall this is what they used to do because the soap was made out of animal fat back then. They would get together, and when the animals were, made into their food, the fat was rendered into the lard that was needed to actually make the soap. And so the whole community would get together and make soap on soap making day and split it up amongst themselves.
I love that.
My grandmother used to do that. I have some of her soap that she made.
Amazing. That's a beautiful story. See, that is a beautiful story. That's exactly the kind of community mobilization that one needs to get. And I think one of the things, this is exactly the kind of community mobilization that needs to start. And it's a lovely story. We at Stanford, one of the things we did was we recently wrote a very interesting case study of Alice Waters' Edible Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Alice Waters has been crusading for is, don't eat mass-produced food. Eat instead locally grown organic food. And what was kind of interesting was, how do you get people to understand what organic food is? And her solution was to kind of make sure schools have edible gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And not only have edible gardens, but they actually kind of introduce, all of this sort of organic material, even in other subjects. So how do you teach math? You don't use abstract examples, but you might use examples from the world of organic food, for instance, and so on and so forth. So the idea is to kind of get them kind of young and early as well, so that they become attuned to the importance of organic materials. So when you gave your lovely example of soap making day, the first reaction I had was, oh my God, this is kind of a little bit like, not only community mobilization, but imagine what would happen if you actually kind of had this done in a school.
Ah, right, to teach
suddenly parents kind of listen enormously to children. When you've got children saying, wait a minute, we're not going to buy all these other things, but instead we actually want to buy these, organically made, products and so on and so forth. I think, That would be an interesting and a different way of creating community mobilization. So
Ask you this, Professor Rao, in your example about the microbreweries and what they did, they ascribe to the mentality that, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships.
Right.
At the same time, how did they maintain individuality so that obviously the idea was that they would be able to not only share information but also brand themselves and be able to make money making beer?
Yes. See, one big advantage in the microbrewing side, you have an inbuilt constraint on scale. Because you're only a microbrewer, you know, if you limit your production, for example. You know, if you take a brew pub, you can only make as much beer and sell it in the brew pub per se. Now, so you had a limitation on scale. That was kind of one. The other important thing was people were using local materials, and so, you know, you wanted to kind of make things regionally unique. You didn't want to create, something that was kind of homogenous and stultifyingly similar all across the nation. And so the idea was, you could have beers in Seattle that were very different than beers, let's say, in Boston or, Maine or and so on and so forth. So sure, you could exchange techniques, but your market is different. Your markets are local rather than necessarily national.
Right, and that's a very interesting distinction because today, mm-hmm. with the advent of the Internet, mm-hmm. local markets are still obviously there, but they are a little bit more diffused, I would think. And also, when it comes to cosmetics, so many of the ingredients are not available locally that you have to be able to find another way to create that regional sort of feel.
Uh-huh. And that's certainly very true, Donna Marie. I mean, you point to, I think, an important distinction between the, if I could call it, the authentic cosmetics industry or the micro cosmetics industry. But even there, one of the things perhaps is maybe they ought to kind of, learn from small farmers. So, you might live in a city, but the farm might not be particularly close to you, it might be kind of far away, but nevertheless, what you can do is you can actually enter into a contract where the farm actually ships you materials every week, for example.
Right, and that happens with a lot of our listeners. They get their herbs and other essential oils and things like that from local distillers and local farmers. But let me ask you what you think about this, and we're going to take a break, so I'm going to ask this question, mm-hmm. and then maybe we'll have a quick break for Professor Rao to think about this. I'm wondering if the parallel to locally sourced ingredients, on a large scale, locally sourced ingredients, if the parallel isn't today the actual person behind that business. Because uh-huh. in today's economy, the way jobs are going, everybody's looking for some kind of business to have. And consumers that there's plenty of money to go around. People are still spending money. A lot of them really do want to be able to buy from someone that they know. I mean, they'll get their toilet paper and other things from large big box stores, but when it comes to personal care products and things like that, studies have shown in recent surveys that that particular industry has not been hurt as much as many other industries, that personal care products have continued to shine in the economy. People continue to buy them. So when we come back, I want to ask Professor Rao about whether the individual, the person stirring the oils, the person making those products, can rise up as that distinctive difference that makes the that separates the microcosmetics industry regionally from the larger companies. We're going to come back and talk with Professor Rao, professor at Stanford University. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're talking with Professor Hayagriva Rao, author of Market Rebels, How Activists Make or Break Radical Innovations, and of course, you micro cosmetics companies out there and other industries that are making products on a small scale are the radical innovations. And before we took a break, I had asked Professor Rao if he thought that from a sociological perspective, because he's such an expert on this area, what is the appeal? How can we benefit from the appeal, Professor Rao, of a consumer being able to buy a cosmetic product, an aromatherapy product, a candle, an earring, jewelry, from someone that they actually can talk to, someone that is a real human being behind that brand? Can we capitalize on that as a as an industry?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In two ways. The first thing is, you know, when you have, as you pointed out, the person stirring the oil and doing things, you know, what that can do is it establishes, of course, a bond between the artisanal producer and the consumer. The second thing is having a personal connection between the producer and the consumer also allows the consumer to personalize, you know, what kind of cosmetics they use. So when you're talking about candles, aromas, materials, and so forth, you know, one would imagine that people have, for example, very specific allergies and the like, and you can actually be very precise and choose kind of what you want to do and so on and so forth. So one of the things that the micro-cosmetics industry, if you will, if I could use such a label, or the natural cosmetics industry or the authentic cosmetics industry, what they could do is to sort of say, look, you know, this is personalized. It's not only authentic, it's personalized. You get to choose, you get to decide what makes sense for you. And so consumers can become, if you will, a little bit of a co-designer or kind of co-participant. So you're not a person passively choosing kind of what's there. The second kind of thing that can happen is, when you establish kind of contact and so forth of a personal kind behind a person stirring the oils and the consumer, this is exactly the way small wine producers market their wines. We've actually been studying wine producers in the Barolo and Barbaresco districts in Italy. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments they make is, look, we want to be authentic.
Right.
We don't want to be like Californian wine or Australian wine.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things they argue is, we're actually, their view is, look, we want to make something distinctive. And when they say something distinctive, something that's actually unique, and it's kind of very interesting, their view is, look, if you want to make authentic wine, the secret actually doesn't lie in the cellar. It actually lies in the vineyard. So one of the things that they kind of point out is, you know what we do? We actually put wine in wood and then give it to you. You know what the others who produce wine for an international taste do? They put wood in the wine.
Oh, and that makes a difference.
Right, because that makes it soft and less tanniny and so forth.
And
their view is,
the parallel for us is that we put a larger percentage of real good ingredients in the products, whereas the larger companies put more fillers in there because they have to.
Exactly. The other interesting thing that these guys, when you talk to the authentic wine producers and you ask them, what's the difference between you and the mass producers or the people who produce for large demand, they'll tell you, look, we make wine so that you can actually drink a bottle of wine in your meal. We're not making wine for you to taste and spit.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, we don't want to make, you know, sweet kind of jammy wine that you say, my God, and then you can only take one sip.
Right, right.
We want to make wine that's, you know, it's a wine that you can actually eat with food.
Right, so, and we want you as cosmetics manufacturers to be able to use the whole product up, not just buy it and like most people do and put it on a shelf somewhere.
That's exactly right. And the question is, it's a family product.
Yeah.
It's something that anybody in the family can potentially use safely, cleanly, and, you know, so forth. You know, without any kind of side effects and the like.
And the family aspect, Professor Rao, does it have another benefit? And that is, again, with today's society being the way it is, with so many people being inspired to start their own businesses, doing whatever their gift or talent is, to be able to do business with another person that has already done that, is one of the ways I think that as we evolve as a society and traditional jobs become fewer and fewer to come by, that we almost have to do that over time.
Well, one certainly has to do that. I mean, this is a way of, if you will, also, in a sense, building numbers in the, you know, microcosmetics industry. It's also a way of creating diversity and variety, because when you have diversity and variety, you have a lot more kind of experiments. But I think what would be kind of interesting from my point of view for the microcosmetic and cosmetics industry is the first thing is to create a sense of community and festivals and, you know, soap days and so on and so forth. They do it not only for the consumers, but also for the producers. The other thing I think is to get to schools, to kind of involve families at a young age and really kind of exploit the angle of personalization. You know, look, you can actually kind of provide input and indeed help design this particular thing because it suits you, because everything is made in small batches. Excuse me.
That's okay. I love that idea. And I know on that note, I know Professor Rao has a busy teaching schedule out there at Stanford University, and I know he has to run to a class, but we have had our own class here today with you, Professor Rao, and we so appreciate it. Your ideas and your responses to the questions were so on target, and we are going to take the information that you shared with us and continue to make a difference for small cosmetics manufacturers and small manufacturers of all kinds across the country. So you'll be hearing from us again. I hope it's okay if we report back to you and let you know what we're doing.
Absolutely. I wish you all the best. As I said, you know, my heart certainly is with Market Rebels.
Thank you so much. And everybody, you can get Professor Rao's book, Market Rebels, How Activists Make or Break Radical Innovations, at Amazon, or any good Google search will bring up some really good reviews of his book. It's really fascinating. We're very excited to have had Professor Rao here with us today. Thank you for your time, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And join me next week, everyone, for another Indie Business Radio show. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.